You got blocked.
Maybe I do.
Get in the way.
Okay, Winnie, I want to do one more ID, and then we'll be all finished.
Okay, I'm ready.
All right, this will be take 102.
This has been the final program in the series Our Nation's Heritage, produced and presented as a public service.
Good, that's it. Thank you.
Well, that's over. Not bad, I'd say. Oh, a little dull in spots, a little confusing in spots, but not bad. No, all in all, I think this series did rather well by me.
And just who are you? How did you get in here anyway?
Who am I? Why, my dear lady, I am the star of the show. History. American history.
Oh, why, so you are. Of course. But oh, I wouldn't have recognized you. You've changed so. Why, I remember you.
Yes? You remember me when?
Well, I mean...
You remember me when I was younger. That's what you're trying to say.
Well...
Younger and more flamboyant. More optimistic. More sure of myself. Huh?
That's right. I remember you used to go around talking about the land of promise and conquering the wilderness and building a mighty industrial empire. Now all you talk about is industrial pollution and how we killed a lot of Indians. I mean, you used to be so much fun.
Well, we all get a little older, you know, a little wiser. Maybe a little sadder.
You used to give us heroes, marvelous figures that we could look up to and feel proud of. Columbus, for example. Now you talk about him as if he were some conniving old miser, capturing Indians, lying. You used to talk about him standing at the helm of his mighty ship, peering toward the unknown horizon, saying, "Sail on!"
Oh, I was very young then, you know. I hadn't learned to listen very carefully, and if I had, I'd have heard Christopher Columbus himself as he spoke through his own journals.
Oh, most excellent gold. Who has gold has a treasure with which he gets what he wants, imposes his will on the world, and even helps souls to paradise.
Columbus and his men suffered and dared. The triumph is theirs. Not to be diminished. But Columbus carried certain ills of his world with him, as did others who came after him. For they were all men of their particular time and their particular place, and I can expect no more of them. Columbus was certainly not alone in his cruelty and greed.
Magellan, for instance. Now, there was a scum-fed old sea dog, if ever there was one.
Or Henry Hudson. But we've heard too much about those blokes as it is. Hudson and Cartier and Drake... What I have against you, history, is that you left us out, the common ordinary seamen. Now, where are our names in your books? I don't see them. Amerigo Vespucci now. He discovered this and that, you say, and so his name is written large across two continents. But what are the men who shared his exact peril? Men who cast upon those strange green waters the one ultimate thing, their lives. Their names are nowhere.
Oh, my dear fellow, I would like to include you, but I can't remember you if records weren't kept. I have no memory of my own. I depend on records, you know, and people's accounts of events. Of course, I can't believe everything I hear. You'd be amazed at the things I've heard in my time.
When I was a boy, I knew an old sailor who'd once gone so far out to sea that he had heard the fiery ball hiss as it sank beneath the waves.
Well, you know, sorting fable from fact has undoubtedly been a problem to man since he first began to speak. And sometimes we've got them twisted around. When Marco Polo came home to Genoa, for instance, and told his wild tales of Cathay and described the coal he'd seen burning there.
He's a great liar, that about black stones that burn. If he'd just stick to his stories of the great bird that can carry off three elephants and the tribe of men with tails like dogs, this one might believe. But the black stones that burn.
Sorting what's true from what's not.
What's true and what's not, that ain't always so easy to say. Remember the old sailors talking of Satan's hand? Laman Satanaxio, they called it. Rising up from the sea every day, a giant black hand it were. And it would snatch at a ship and draw it down, down deep into the sea. Now men say that's no more than a myth. that every shoal and reef that took a crew and flung it to the sea ain't nothing more than Leman Satanaxio.
Yes, yes. Fables are a sort of history. Poetic history. They usually preserve one essential truth, like a fly in amber. Consider the people of the plains and their tale about Corn Mother.
Then Corn Mother thrust up through the earth into the light, but the earth was tight around her shoulders, and then, crack! Thunder shook the earth loose, and Corn Mother and all the people and animals could come up into the light and walk upon the earth.
Oh, that's just plain silly. We didn't come from under the earth.
Oh, didn't we? That is, didn't our life come from the soil? Now, these were people from the plains, remember. The people of the coast had other tales of how life comes from the sea. It's too bad I don't have a record of when these first Americans got here, or how they got here, or their first impressions of the white man. No, fables and tales are good for essential truths, but I do like details. Sometimes, just sometimes, mind, I get a glimpse through an open door, a little view of what everyday life was for those countless people who were simply never seen by me. How many I have missed. Thank goodness for diaries and letters. If it weren't for diaries and letters, we'd never know the little things. What Martha Washington wore to the inauguration, for instance, or what the French voyageurs wore in the wilds of Canada in the 18th century.
Must put down a description of their dress. How colorful it is. Moccasins, deerskin leggings, and a breechcloth with a long shirt overall. And on their heads, bright woolen caps, and around their waists, gaudy sashes from which hang beaded bags. And I think every one of them smokes a clay pipe.
Now, some people might not think knowing that was important, but it gives us a picture in our minds and brings them that much closer to us. And letters. Letters can give you marvelous glimpses of people. Mary Washington, for instance, George's mother.
I've never lived so poor in my life. Was it not for Mr. French and your sister, I should be almost starved. But I'm like an old almanac, quite out of date.
Oh, you don't have to believe what people say in letters, you know. But they do tell you a lot about them that you might never learn any other way. You remember that crusty teacher in the Shenandoah Valley who seemed to hate just about everything and everybody? And yet he wrote most sweetly to his wife in the Shetland Islands.
And I yet hope, please God, to make you a Virginia lady among the woods of America. And yet to make you eat more wheat bread in your old age than what you have done in all your youth.
One of the sorrows of my early life was when Martha Washington burned her letters.
Those letters, they belonged to me. Besides, I didn't want to leave lying around a lot of letters about manure and how I shouldn't let Harriet leave a room so messy and all that. No, I'd rather have people remember him as just a great man.
Well, instead, they remember him as a pale, pompous man in a gold frame. Now, if we could have seen those letters, he might have remained more human, don't you think? Well, as it turned out, his wooden false teeth have been the subject of altogether too much attention. Now, why do you suppose people are so interested in the fact that he had ill-fitting wooden false teeth? Because it made him ridiculous? Oh, I don't think so. I think because it made him more human, gave him some reality.
It is a subject of marvel that this great man should be given reality, as you say. It's true he was not a talkative man, but he filled a room with his presence. But then you can hand someone's words down through the years. You can't hand down the sense of the man, the presence, the charisma.
Yes, if people won't write things down. Now, Thomas Jefferson, he was a man after my own heart. Wrote about 36,000 letters and kept copies of them. And then his diaries, his account books. Oh, Thomas Jefferson is very clear to me. What he planted.
Carrots from Pisa, salmon radishes, lettuce lettuce.
His first impressions of Paris, while he was still grieving for Martha.
But I am savage enough to prefer the woods, the wilds, and the independence of Monticello to all the brilliant pleasures of this gay capital.
His reaction to the Daniel Shea uprising.
God forbid that we should every 20 years be without such a rebellion. What signify a few lives lost in a century or two? The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. It is its natural manure.
And it was all his, you know. I mean, in recent years, I'm not always sure who's talking. President Roosevelt or Robert Sherwood? President Nixon or Ron Ziegler? Now, when Jefferson said...
It is its natural manure.
You knew he was really saying it. Well, I admit I'm partial to Thomas Jefferson. He had such a clear sense of me, if I do say so. He and John Adams both. I mean, dying like that on the 50th anniversary of the first 4th of July. You'll admit that showed a remarkable grasp of my importance.
Me too.
Yes. Yes, very nice.
I tell you things too, you know.
Pardon me?
Music informs history, too. You keep talking about diaries and letters, but songs preserve the spirit of the time, the feeling of the people, vivid and direct as only sound can be, without all those words.
Painting and drawing.
Well, what about them?
A picture is worth a thousand words.
Yes, I do like the details.
Then think about the covers on the albums in this series. That painting by John Trumbull, the Declaration of Independence, for instance. Doesn't it take you there?
Oh, a lot of frozen figures. Flat. Flat and frozen. Music now, lively and gives you the spirit.
Not the details. Not what men wore or sat on or how long their hair
was.
No,
just what men felt.
Art is much more reliable.
You know, that painting of the Declaration of Independence, for example?
Well, yes.
But Trumbull was never there. And he painted in a couple of men who weren't there either. At least not when the Committee of Five submitted the draft of the Declaration, which is supposedly what's happening. And he probably gave Thomas Jefferson a red waistcoat just to balance the rest of the colors in the picture. Details indeed. Besides, they all look drunk. And what's the table standing on? It hasn't any legs.
Well, it gives you the general...
Art is unreliable.
But music is not.
I preserve the spirit.
Yes, I know the spirit of the time. Like that silly ballad of the tea party.
Overboard she goes, my boys, heave-ho, where darkling waters roar. We love our cup of tea full well, but love our freedom more. With a ring-tum, ding-tum, fa-la-ling-tum, love our freedom more. With a ring-tum, ding-tum, fa-la-ling-tum, love our freedom more.
Do you think that was really the feeling of those early patriots who risked their fortunes, maybe even their lives, that night on the Boston Wharf? These were solemn men, bent on a deadly serious act of protest. So serious and so dangerous that they swore each other to secrecy. So to this day, we don't know exactly who was there and who was not.
Yes, such a pity. Secrecy always has been hard on me. Though usually, someone babbles sooner or later. But not that time, though. At least not within my earshot.
So, if we can't trust history, or music, or art, what can we trust?
Oh, you can trust us, dear lady. Just not blindly. There's very little in life that can be said with complete confidence. Is the world flat, I ask? Oh, good heavens, no. You say it's round. But now they say it tends to be shaped more like an egg. No, our understandings change, and it's good they do. For if they did not, it would mean we had stopped learning. Our understandings change. Men themselves change, for that matter. For instance... Could you say that George Washington enjoyed a battle? If there were a question on an examination, say, that asked simply, did George Washington enjoy war? Well, listen to these words written by the young Washington.
Dear Jack, I have heard the bullets whistle, and believe me, there is something charming in the sound.
Years later, a friend of Washington's asked if it were true that the sound of whistling bullets held a charm for him.
If I said so, it was when I was young.
So you see, how could you answer a simple yes or no? Our great men, like the rest of us, are just men, after all. Not the same from one day to the next, let alone from young to old. And where they were and what they were doing makes a difference to them, as it does to every man. Well, our expecting too much of our heroes has been largely my fault. I've been careless in the past, too fond of putting it all on these few men who stand out. You know, the father of our country and all that.
But George was the father of our country.
Well, of course, as his wife, you would think that, Mrs. Washington.
Well, no, not just me. It has been variously said that if it hadn't been for George's particular personality, there is doubt about the outcome of the revolution. And there is also doubt that the new government could have survived it all those first few years. No, he served his country, but more than that, he fashioned his country. Out of the snows of that winter at Valley Forge, out of the tedium of the convention in 87, out of the anguish of those 8 years and the whole ache of his own tired frame, he fashioned it.
So it was your man made the country. Sometimes when I'd fought the harsh edge of the world and cradled my babes and sowed my garden and chopped my kitchen wood and seen my son go off to war and nursed my sick ones and spent 1,000 weary evenings spinning by the fire to keep mine covered from the wind, sometimes I fancied it was me had made this country.
Well, there it is again, you see. That problem. Is it a few leaders here and there who make events? Or is it those individuals as anonymous to me as grains of sand? Clear to themselves, mind you, each with a vivid life that has its own shape, its own crises and triumphs and rich moments, but to me, as indistinguishable as grains of sand.
So if that's true, how'd we get to hear Ma Deacon stuck out there on the edge of the frontier?
Oh, well, that was made up, you know, to give voice to those who've had no voice. In fact, I noticed that this series is mostly made up. Dramatized history, they call it.
Mostly made up?
All they use direct quotes whenever they could. The script on the Declaration of Independence, for example, is made up almost entirely of direct quotes. And Columbus. Everything he says was taken from his diary.
Let's forget Columbus.
Forget Columbus?
I just meant that...
Yes, well, they've quoted directly whenever they could, but most of the stories are made up. Details researched. What they wore, what they ate, what they needed, what they feared. These are a matter of record, but the people to fill out the details, they were mostly made up.
That's pretty obvious.
But what may not be obvious is that some of the so-called real people I talk about are almost as fictional. Crispus Attucks, for instance, and his role in the Boston Massacre. I'm pretty sure he was a mulatto seaman who led a crowd down a Boston street toward the Redcoats on the Commons and got shot sometime that evening. But I really don't know much more than that.
Yeah, you don't know much about anything, really, do you?
Well,
I think you're entertaining. I like to listen to you, imperfect or not. Of course you can't record everything that happened. If you did, you couldn't fit into our lives. You've got to be just bits and pieces. But they give us hints of how things were and maybe even of how things should be. And of course you've got to change as your understanding changes.
Well, it makes me feel downright insecure. I mean, what can we count on anymore? Columbus, for example. Why, when I was a child...
Columbus. What's so important about Columbus? He didn't even set foot on America anyway.
Now, look here.
You had a phony image of him, that's all.
Well, I don't care. He was my Columbus.
Then believe in him, dear lady. You won't be the first to ignore the facts. Besides, I've come to have a healthy distrust of facts. Perhaps his journal was a forgery. What do I really know about him? Perhaps he was a Jew instead of a Catholic. Perhaps he was a woman in disguise. Perhaps he never lived at all.
How dare you?
I merely said perhaps.
Well, I refuse to listen to your perhaps.
Once you refuse perhaps, you refuse me.
What I want are some things I can believe in. Some heroes and some stories about the good, brave things Americans have done. Stories that will give us pride again and make us feel good.
I tell those things as often as I can.
And I don't want to hear about all the rest.
Ah, you don't want me then. You want romance. Oh, they do a good job of that in the Soviet Union, I'm told. Editing their history so that they come out looking good every time. But then I can't pretend that I'm truly balanced. I try, but I'm not saying that I don't have my biases, my fantasies.
Fantasies? You're not supposed to have fantasies. You're supposed to tell us the truth.
Ah, the truth. But which truth? Whose truth? And what is truth anyway?
Now, don't go rambling off on some philosophical claptrap.
No. I assure you, this is not idle talk. It's a very real problem. A problem, if I may say so, that you should consider every time you tell anybody anything.
Me? Keep me out of this.
Oh, but I can't. What am I, after all, but a collection of the opinions and recollections of a lot of men and women, each with his poor memory, his passions, his self-interest, his occasional tendency to bend the truth to fit his fancy. No, each time you relate an incident to someone else, you're adding to me. And sometimes you yourselves are not sure what you see. The soldiers in Cortez's army, for instance, as they entered Mexico.
Some of our soldiers even asked whether the things we saw were not in a dream.
Man sees nothing whole. Take five men and spring a tiger on them. Two will say it was a leopard, two will say a cheetah, and one will say it never happened at all. You know, in court, there's a comical phrase. The witness promises to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Imagine.
What's so funny about that?
Oh, my friend. The whole truth? Why, do you know what that would mean? The direction each blade of grass was bending, the date of the old newspaper scudding by his feet, the temperature of the air, the color of his socks, the number on the streetcar that was passing
no,
by.
No, only relevant things. A witness is asked to tell the whole truth only about relevant things.
Ah, and once you limit your truth to so-called relevant things, you are selecting, aren't you? And the way you select will depend upon your own judgment. And your judgment will have been affected by your poor memory, your passions, your self-interest, and your occasional tendency to bend the truth to fit your fancy, right?
Yeah.
Well, this, of course, is the reason I change from one era to the next, from one place to another, and why I never tell the whole truth. Consider the great Aztec civilization.
So, my friend, you see what remains of our city, a city feared and admired by all who knew its name. Now, what will the stories tell of us, children of the sun?
They will only tell of the gold, the battle, and the blood.
Then our children will no longer listen to our stories.
Stories of the medicine men? They could not stop the pale invaders. Children will not listen to stories of old fools.
Well, and facts do get handed down so carelessly. Take the origin of the name Shenandoah.
It means daughter of the stars. Ain't that beautiful? Them Indians sometimes do get the prettiest ideas.
Ha! Shows what you'll swallow in that dreamy head of yours, you goose. Shenandoah's named after the old Iroquois chief Sharando. Just got the sounds a little stretched out.
Well, now, I heard it as Shenandoah, meaning the river through the spruces.
Just how many spruces you seen hereabouts?
Daughter of the stars. That's what it means. Daughter of the stars.
Ah, perhaps you begin to see my problems. I fear I'm easily confused.
What I cannot quite understand, you will forgive me, sir, is how you could confuse me with that old reprobate.
And you are?
John Brown, at your service.
You ain't John Brown. You ain't nothing but a figment of some soggy-minded imagination. Now I'm the real John Brown.
Uh-oh, I was afraid of something like this.
Well, do something, history. There are two men standing there, both claiming to be John Brown.
I'm sorry, I just don't have enough data to determine which one is the imposter.
Sir?
Yeah, watch your tongue, you.
I have eyewitness accounts attesting to the fact that John Brown was a saint and a martyr.
I thank you, good sir.
And I have other eyewitness accounts that make him out to be a bloodthirsty ruffian.
Listen, it took a real man to do what I did. No spineless, lily-toting saint could have started up that war.
I don't think there's any profit in continuing this conversation with an imposter.
Oh, you don't, eh? You don't much like this, do you? Eyeball to eyeball. Well, I've had enough of your pious ways. Been plaguing me more than a century now. I've had a bellyful.
I bid you good day.
Oh, no, you don't.
Take your hands off me, sir.
Push me, will you? You think you're God Almighty. Well, now, this is it. Take that.
Goodness, they're still going at it. John Brown versus John Brown.
They'll never settle it that way. But then Americans do seem to like to fight. That is, they like to go into a fight. Usually, the fight itself is not as much fun as they expected. But more about that on the other side of the record.
This has been another program in the series Our Nation's Heritage, produced and presented as a public service by Standard Oil Company of California.